Hello and welcome to Boring Beige Box, the weekly podcast about retro computing. I'm your host, Matt Wilson. If you like to hack away at your autoexec.bat or config.sys files just so you can play King's Quest or Ultima, you're at the right place. From 2400 baud modems to IBM PS1s, to Monkey Island 2, to the Sierra Network, we cover it all if it happened in the 80s and 90s. So clean out that garage, pull out that old boring beige box, and let's have some fun. Welcome to Boring Beige Box. This is show number 9 for Saturday, June 17th, 2006. Today's topic is computer games. Part 1. Hey, how's it going, guys? Sorry that it has been a while since I've done the podcast. It has been crazy. The summer is obviously here, and trying to make the transition into summer is pretty nuts. I mean, everyone wants to be outside and go do things with the wife and the families. And I think last weekend or around Memorial Day weekend, I think I went. We have a water park that's close by to us here in Northwest Indiana. A place called Deep River Water Park, and let me tell you, it's awesome. I went twice in the same weekend. Once with my wife, and then we have two kids, a 2-year-old, not our children, but these are our godchildren. We're the godparents for these kids, a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old that we keep sometimes, and we took them to the water park. So, I mean, everybody is outside, place is packed. I mean, you know, it's summer. Summer's here. So even today, you know, I've got it's time to work on the yard. I got a lot of stuff. The grass is dying a little bit in some areas, so I got to get some fertilizer and stuff like that. So anyway, summer is here, but I am very excited about this edition of Boring Beige Box. Today we're going to talk about the wonderful world of computer games, and computer gaming holds a special place in my life, growing up, especially in the late 80s, early to mid 90s, and on. But there's a lot of games that I want to cover, and just game companies and stuff I want to talk about, and what it was like during that time to be a computer gamer, and some of the experiences that I had with computer games. First off, I want to read some emails. I got a few emails in from a couple people. There are, let's see, a couple people let me know about not getting the podcast in last week. I am very, very sorry. Once again, like I said, it's just been very hectic. So the last show was like 2 weeks ago. But I'm back on track now, and I should be pumping them out every week. I had a lot of stuff going on with work, and I was doing a lot of research and a lot of studying. I'm an IT guy, network administrator, so a lot of times you have to keep your skills up. And I was just doing some hardcore studying certain technologies and stuff last weekend, and actually over the past 2 weeks, so it's been really nuts lately. So anyway, I got a few emails here. One of them comes from Joel, and Joel writes, he goes, "Hello, you have a good podcast, but one reason you aren't getting much email is that the link on your website is to the main page." I did notice this. The website is just basically a gateway or a point to go to either the forums or to the listing of all the podcast episodes. on the Libsyn site. So when you go to our website, which is www.boringbeigebox.com, you'll notice that it is pretty bare with just some basic information. But from that site, you can click on podcast info, which takes you to the Libsyn hosted site, which has a list of all the podcasts where you can directly download them, listen to them that way. And you can also, if you use the hot technology right now is RSS, Real Simple Syndication, where you can use a program, like it's called a newsreader or a news aggregator. There's one that I use called FeedReader, which is free, and you can have all your, you can subscribe to the blogs that you read and to any podcasts that have RSS attached to them. So with Libsyn, all of this is, they provide RSS feeds for your podcast. So I could subscribe, that's how it works with iTunes. Basically, you subscribe to the feed for my podcast, and it pulls that down. So whenever I update and upload a new show, it pulls that information from the RSS feed and lets you know that there's a new show there. Works the same way with blog postings. If I actually have a blog, a personal blog, where I talk about work and life and different things, that's at mattwilson247.blogs.com. And that's hosted with a company I use called TypePad, and that has an RSS feed, so people can subscribe to it. So if you go to boringbeigebox.com, click on podcast info, there are some buttons on the left-hand side. You could use the feed burner one. That's a fairly good one. Either the feed burner, or you can use the one that says RSS 2.0. And then the one below it is like the icon, the standard icon for RSS feed, which is an orange square with some lines on it. And then there's also, it shows how many, below that there's an icon that says that I have 6 readers. So that's people that have just subscribed to the feed burner RSS tag, which are the RSS feed provided by FeedBurner. It's just a better way to track to see who is subscribed to that. But that's not people who download, that's just who people have set that subscription in, like a newsreader. So you can, you know, when you can whenever there's updates to the show. Also in Firefox, if you use Firefox web browser, they have something called, there are links at the top, they're called live bookmarks, and you can, if you go to a page that has an RSS feed built into it, right at the toolbar at the top, right next to the web address, you should see that little orange square icon, and you can click on it, and it'll add a live bookmark to your link list at the top of your browser, so that you can, or it adds it to your bookmarks, either the bookmark toolbar or your bookmarks, and then you can always click on that, and it gives you a drop down right there on the screen to show you all the shows or all the postings for the show. So there's some great technologies out there that are available like that. You also on the website, you know, like I said, boringbeigebox.com is just, it's a gateway. So you can click on forums, it takes you to the forums, and then there's one I did called, a page called Old School Ads, which has, you know, ads of some old beige boxes from the good old days. So on the forums, I have had a couple people, you know, mentioned that they missed the show last week. A guy named Daniel, really nice guy that I've also talked to through instant messaging. So he did definitely mention that he missed the episode last week. So, and I did put up a few posts saying that there were delays. Emails. So Joel says that he talks about how he started doing IT work during the age. He says, I started doing IT work during the ages where most users had the original IBM PS or PC XT box on their desk with a third-party RAM card expansion. He says, my actual computer and electronics training all took place during the 1980s, so I'm more into retro bits. That's true. A lot of people find out about this show from RetroBit. So I've got people that are that use some of the older technology that find out about this show. This show is a little bit later than some of the stuff he seems like he was into. He says, my department had the first 386 that hit the building, and it was an amazing piece of work. We were using a lot of DOS-based programs at the time, DesignCAD, WordPerfect 5.1, and so on. And he talks about some different things. He mentioned having he was so happy the day he got the Windows 3.1 Bible. And I totally remember those like Bible-type books. I also got an email saying that we were added to the Pod Lounge. Looks like it's an Australian company. That was nice. That was really good to be added to that. It's thepodlounge.com.au. So it looks like they're Australian. Also got an email from Callum, C-A-L-L-U-M. He says he gives me some tips, talks about he loves the podcast. He agrees with me, and I mentioned this last episode. You know, I'm really not into too much. I don't feel like it's important to do a historical timeline of everything. I think it's a little bit as good for context, but, you know, it's more about my personal experiences with some of these technologies and what happened. And by doing that, I hopefully can, you know, excite you or get you feeling nostalgic about certain time periods, and so that you're able to, you know, remember those times, find some old hardware, find some old systems to play around with, you know, play some old computer games, and remember those days. There's a lot of stuff out there. I mean, it's my goal is to do that, is to just to get you excited or get you nostalgic about those days, you know, whether it be bulletin board systems. You know, we talked about that, and there's, you know, still a lot of BBSs online that you can dial into or either use Telnet to get to. There's a lot of people talking about some of that old stuff that that we did with the BBSs, or online services, talking about the old days of AOL and CompuServe and the Sierra Network, and also, you know, computer games, old hardware, stuff you used to do with it, you know, going into your garage and finding those old computers, or either collecting them and just having a bunch of them to play around with. I mean, that's the whole thing about having fun. Now, I know it's the summer, and, you know, you might not be into it as much, especially in the garage if it's hot in there. I know for me, I'm probably not going to be in the garage that much this summer. A little bit if it's a cooler day, but I want to actually talk about that later in the show when we get into the computer games. But there's ways to do things on your regular computer system without even through emulation. You don't even have to fool with your old systems if you don't want to. I really think that you know, messing around with your old hardware, your 386s, 486s, the best time to do that is usually around the fall. And I think when it starts to get cooler outside, you can go in the garage more and hook stuff up, and it's a little bit more comfortable out there in the garage. So right now for me, the garage is just a place where we keep our lawnmower and our soil and stuff that we're using to work on the yard. So anyway, Callum gives some tips and pointers, and thank you, Callum, for all this time and effort. That every email I get is usually a really long emails. He gave a lot of tips and pointers about possibilities for the show, and I won't go over all of them, but he did mention this, which I thought was very interesting, and I am thinking of doing, but taking taking episodes of Computer Chronicles, you know, from if you go to www.archive.org, they have tons of episodes of the old Computer Chronicles show with Stuart Chaffee from I believe it was usually on PBS, and there's tons of episodes. I've watched a lot of them. I actually download them, the highest quality ones, which are, I think, MPEG-2. They're usually over a gig a piece, but you just have to let it go for a couple hours. But anyway, I download them, and I can burn them. I have software that I can burn them to DVD and then watch them in my DVD player. And the picture quality is perfect. It's just like you're watching a regular TV show. So thankfully for them, they have plenty of storage space and bandwidth to host all of those old shows. But archive.org is the site. So he mentions talking about, you know, reviewing some of those shows and talking about some of the shows that are on there. And I think that's a great idea. Because I've watched a bunch of them, and they have a lot of relevance to some of the stuff that we talk about on Boring Beige Box. So some of the other things were, let's see here. He talked about interviewing Earl Evans, and I would love to interview Earl from Retro Bits and kind of get his opinion on things and talk about, you know, just the community, the vintage retro computing community, and his experiences with the show. So Earl, if you're listening, we need to set this up, but I'll probably send you an email about it. But that would be definitely be cool. I still have to learn how you would do an interview with someone live while you're recording without him being here. I know that you can use Skype and stuff, but I've got to figure out how all that technology works and stuff. So, otherwise, that was pretty much, you know, Callum gave a bunch of other topics. I won't go over them, but he really gave some great insight. And also a guy by the name of John, he goes by Winston, that was his handle back in the day. He mentioned, he wrote in, and he goes, "Thanks so much for including my email to you about the 1986 usage of Boring Beige Box in episode," the actual quote. If you remember that, I talked about, this guy sent me in a article that he scanned in that used the term Boring Beige Box from 1986, and which I thought was very, very cool. And he says, "I had no idea you'd be that enthusiastic about it." I was. I thought it was the coolest thing. I mean, anyone that, okay, you know, right off the bat, all this stuff is just for fun. You know, this is just something that is fun to do, and you enjoy doing it. And you know, computing and being into computers is a hobby. It's a passion for some people. I mean, the reason I do it for a living now is because it's my passion. I love computers. I love working with technology. I love being able to solve people's problems through technology, and I love taking things apart, trying to make them work again, and seeing how they work, and just that exploration that you have with computing is incredible. So. Yeah, I mean, for anyone to send in an article, to take time to scan an article in from an old magazine that they're reading and email it to me, and listen to the show and would find that topic and stuff, or find that you know, our catchphrase, the title of our podcast, I applaud you. I mean, I say, hey, thank you so much for doing that. That really means that you're interested in this stuff. So. Thanks so much, John. I really appreciate it. But anyway, he says that he wants to be able to. I mean, he's got a complete set of PC Magazine from the time period. He says, "I've got a complete run of that magazine from 1986 through, I think, 2002, which is great. There's a lot of stuff. I don't have as many as my old magazines as I used to. I used to have tons of the big old oversized computer shopper magazines, but I only have a few random magazines called PC Sources and a couple PC magazines and Windows and stuff like that, Windows magazines, but not that many. So, John, I would definitely tell you, or Winston as you go by, definitely anything that you can find, you know, whatever it might be, you can see anything about 486 machines or any type of technology which you think that would be cool that was talked about in the late 80s and early 90s. I really want to talk about, in a future podcast, I want to move towards the whole online craze, or the evolution of people getting on the internet. So any type of modem technologies or anything that dealt with online services and stuff like that, I really want some more information on that. But also hardware, 486s, like graphics hardware, how graphic cards change things, and monitors and stuff like that, and how that all, like the whole, you know, VGA to Super VGA, all of that stuff is very interesting to me. So definitely, Winston, if you have any of that, just scan it in and send me the articles. So that's it for email. Let's get started. I know I spent a long time on the beginning part, but let's get started. This is going to be a longer show, and it's probably going to be a two-parter. I might split it up, but I did say that it was part one, so I'm probably going to split it up into two segments. So let's talk about computer games. For me, I believe that the reason I got a computer was to play computer games. Like I've said in the past, I saved up one summer and I bought my first computer. I basically was sick of the console games. You know, I love Nintendo. Nintendo is incredible. But at that point, I just wanted something more. I wanted to go deeper. And fortunately for me, this was at a time when computer games were at their best as far as the things that you could do with them and, you know, the ability to, I guess, you know, you really had control over a lot of the games, and there was so much wealth of information about computer games, and it was extremely hot at this time. This was late 80s, early 90s. The console games were just action games, were fun. They were limited by, you know, cheap hardware and you know, pretty and simplistic gameplay. I felt that you know, RPGs, role-playing games, and adventure games started with the PC. And that's really what I want to focus on. I want to talk about the adventure game genre and the RPG genre, role-playing games. And basically, for me, the first game I got was The Secret of Monkey Island 2 by LucasArts. And the next game I got was Ultima 7 by Origin. Now, like I said, this is probably going to be a two-parter, and I want to focus on adventure games and RPGs, and probably move, once I start towards the RPG, well, at the end of the RPG discussion, I want to talk about single-player RPG, but I definitely want to get into online RPGs and online gaming, and I may do the second part of the show will probably be, majority will be about online gaming. If not, I will do a completely separate show just on online gaming, because it's a huge discussion on online games. So let's first talk about, now I did the show on LucasArts a couple shows back, but I want to talk about Sierra for a little bit. Sierra is probably, LucasArts and Sierra battle for the throne of the adventure game genre. I really think, though, that Sierra probably wins out just because of the amount of games that they came out with. There's some really good articles. Now, there's a lot of stuff out there on the adventure game genre. First off, I'd like to say the adventure game genre is pretty much dead. I mean, there are a few games that come out every now and then, but it pretty much died when first-person shooters came out. This was at a time around the mid-90s. I think the reason is the main idea is that the 3D, everything that came out with 3D technology pretty much killed that genre. But what just makes me sad is that because of that, you lose all that great storytelling and that very in-depth storylines and plot lines that adventure games had. Like I said, my first one was Monkey Island 2, which was great. I mean, it was hilarious. It had a great story. I mean, there's so much to do. You have to, you really have to work your brain. You really have to figure stuff out. It's the point of, I think that was the whole point of computer games, is, you know, it was more in depth than just your Super Mario Brothers. You know, it had a story. It had a world that you could live in. And I did. Every time you fire up that game, you're in that world. You know, with Monkey Island 2 and a lot of the subsequent or the following games, the colors and the music and the different things that you did, you really felt like you were in that world. Now, I know you look at it now and you're like, what? It was a 2D, you know, very stale, linear environment. It was nothing like 3D, you know, 3D worlds, it's like virtual reality, whatever. I hate that term, but it's, you feel like you're in the game with 3D, and you do. I mean, but there's something about, I guess you would say, you know, in modern days they call it, or well, modern online role-playing games, they call it lore. Like World of Warcraft has a lot of lore to it, a lot of story, a lot of background, but it's still, it feels departed because the mechanics of the game overtake the story of the game. And that's where I think that has become the problem. With adventure games and even role-playing games early on, it's about the story. It's not really about the game mechanics or how well you do something, but it's more about the story, which I love. I mean, I love reading. I've always grown up reading, you know, tons of books and all different types, fantasy, science fiction, typical geek, you know, stuff. And with computer games, you were able to live out those stories, or you could be a part of those stories. So that's, you know, that's why I loved the adventure games. You could really get into the story. So Sierra started in the 70s. Ken Williams, Roberta Williams, husband and wife, they started in, with Sierra in the 70s, and they came out probably about the late, I would say the late 70s, they came out with Mystery House. Now, I won't give too much history because, once again, this is stuff I just don't, you know, I wasn't a part of. But in the early days, they started off with Mystery House. It was the first 3D. It was black and white, but it was graphical, and it got away from the text-based games. Now, really, the adventure game genre started with text-based games as early as the early 70s. If you remember games like Zork and some of the other games by Infocom, which were real popular, that really started a lot of the adventure game genre, because it was sometimes what people call it interactive fiction, but it was text-based adventures where you would type in commands and you would, you know, do different things and complete quests and stuff like that. But it was more of like pick up this, do this. It was the forerunner, the basis for graphical adventure games. So beginning in the 80s, they started coming out with you know, all the King's Quest games, all the way up through the 90s. Let me see here. If you go to Wikipedia and look up Sierra Online, they list all of their games. Now, there was multiple series. I mean, I'm amazed at all the games that they pumped out. Some of the ones that I remember that I played, well, obviously the ones I played the most were the King's Quest series. Now, I really didn't play like 1, 2, 3, or 4. I got into King's Quest and King's Quest 5. And the reason is for one, that was when I first bought a computer, but also the graphics for King's Quest V were amazing. Like, everything was hand-drawn. This became a time when artists would draw the scenes and they would scan them in, and then your character would move throughout the scenes. So King's Quest V was beautiful. So I played that a lot. I don't think I ever beat it. I might have, but the puzzles were extremely hard. Sierra was known for extremely hard puzzles, and I would always end up downloading the hints, and I just wanted to get through the game because I wanted to see what would happen next. So some of the stuff I would try to figure out myself, but most of it, you know, I would get the cheats for. So the cool thing was is that it went from a period, you start with the interactive fiction, the text-based games, everything is command line driven, and you have to type in commands for what you want your character to do. But later, it got into graphical base. So I believe that it might have been King's Quest IV. Either 4 or 5 was the first time that it used graphical-based interaction, where you click on things and you use a menu and stuff, and it's a lot easier to use than typing in commands. So King's Quest went up through... I remember playing King's Quest VI. That was also a really good one. But that was pretty much it. Then there was like King's Quest VII, which was not as popular, and then King's Quest VIII. And then they pretty much stopped that line. Also, Space Quest was really good. I played that a little bit, the whole Roger Wilco stuff. It was pretty cool. It was funny. So I didn't play that a whole lot, though. And then Leisure Suit Larry. That, as being a teenager growing up, I mean, to play anything, to have a game that had some sort of sexual content was, you know, was a big deal. So I remember playing a couple of those. I never was allowed to buy them and stuff, but I think I remember getting a copy of one of them. I can't remember which one. I never really played too much of the Leisure Suit Larry, but it was, I was always looking at the ads. So the Leisure Suit Larry stuff I remember was playing in Larry Land in Sierra Online. That was a lot of fun, playing in the casino games. There's an I forgot that they did that Sierra did this series, Lords of the Realm, which was really good. I enjoyed that series. Police Quest, that was another real famous series that they actually used real police officers to, or it was a police officer, detective, or something like that actually contributed to the making of the game. And there was also the Quest for Glory series, which I never really got into either. And they did some other stuff. I really didn't care for their whole Gabriel Knight and the Phantasmagoria and all that stuff, the horror-type genre games. I really just never liked that stuff. The full motion video, it was, you know, cool at its time, but I always thought it was very cheesy looking because the quality was really bad. So anyway, really from Sierra, it was King's Quest. That's what it was all about for me. So definitely loved King's Quest. They also did some very innovative stuff, the Incredible Machine games, and the... they did a couple different ones. I don't know if you remember The Heart of China. That always had really cool graphics. I remember it was a lot of these games were made by Dynamix, which was a company that they had Sierra had acquired. They had some really cool stuff, different type of games, like Freddy Farkas was interesting, and The Adventures of Willie Beamish. So there were some pretty cool games that they came out with. Basically, Sierra, they did well for a long time. They became more of like a distributor. They were bought by Vivendi, Universal, and they pretty much when the adventure games began to die out in the mid to late 90s, these companies got bought up or they sold out to larger companies. You know, it was pretty sad, but Sierra is just pretty much a brand name now. I think they closed their Bellevue offices a couple years ago. So, but now there's some great stuff out there about the classic days of Sierra. Ken Williams actually keeps his own website, which I think is awesome. It's SierraGamers.com, and he posts in the forums. It's his site. He talks about it. There is a great message board section that you got to check out. And I mean, he's always posting. It's really, really cool. And he talks about just the history. There's a lot of articles out there on the history of Sierra. Just do some searches on Google and you can find them. There's interviews and stuff on Gama Sutra, and I'll try to put these in the show notes, the links to the different interviews for Ken Williams. So the other cool thing about Sierra, obviously, was for me, which was really close to me and was special for me, was the Sierra network. I mean, it had all the feelings and designs and look of a Sierra game. Every place that you went to on the Sierra online network or the Sierra network felt like a Sierra game. The games you played, it was very Sierra-like, and that was the biggest thing for me. I mean, they did some incredible work with that. Also, I don't know if you remember, Sierra came out with a magazine called Interaction, and on his website, on Ken Williams' website, SierraGamers.com, there is scans of the different covers of the magazine, Interaction magazine. also, I'm just kind of looking on the site now. He has some links and stuff to different people that were involved and different fan sites. I mean, there's fan sites for everything. If you remember with the Sierra Network, there is Eusebius, the Shadows of Eusebius role-playing game up in Medieval Land. It's Eusebius.org is a group of people that are trying to recreate playing Eusebius online. So you can check that out at Eusebius.org. That's Y-S-E-R-B-I-U-S.org. And I know I've talked about that in the past, but it's definitely something to check out. But if you go to his website, SierraGamers.com, there's tons of links on his Cool Sierra Links page. And there's another site that I'm forgetting about that has a lot of stuff. Yeah, VintageSierra.com. It's Vintage-Sierra.com. It's pretty extensive, all the games and what they talk about. And a lot of screenshots, so that'll bring back good memories. So the adventure genre was pretty much dominated by LucasArts and Sierra. Now, I've talked about LucasArts in the past. I can kind of talk about what I have here. I'm actually looking at some boxes. I have a lot of my old computer games left. I have my original Monkey Island 2 box with the 3.5 floppies, which I don't think work anymore. I think I tried the other weekend to install it, and they don't work. But that's okay, because I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what you can do to play some of these games. So I have the Monkey Island 2 box with, I love the requirements on the front. It says AT or compatible, 10 megahertz, 286 or faster required, 640K RAM required, VGA/MCGA 256 colors. Supports Adlib, Roland, Sound Blaster, and Sound Master 2 sound cards. 1.4M, 3.5-inch disc. Hard drive required. So, it had very low requirements, but I remember, you know, you really had to have a good 386 machine to play it. 486, even better. But it could run pretty well. I ran it on a 386 machine with no problem. Also, I have the classic Sam & Max Hit the Road. This was probably the most funniest game for me, for LucasArts. Just a classic game. I really want to play this again. I have not played this in so long. I have the CD-ROM edition, and man, I've got to play that, because it's a great summer game, because of they take a trip across the country. And, wow, this also has a copy of Day of the Tentacle in here. I didn't even know that. That's cool. Yeah, I got to play that. Maniac Mansion, Day of the Tentacle. That's cool. It comes with it. Anyway, I think it did, or maybe I just had it in there or something. Anyway, but yeah, Sam & Max Hit the Road is great. Really, really funny game. So, yeah, I got to play that. So, anyway, Also, I have a bunch of games at home. I'm getting ready to go home to my parents' house in about a week or two, and I've got a bunch of games in the attic that I need to bring back with me. I might have my original King's Quest V box and CD. So, anyway, so the adventure game genre, I feel really, it kind of, you know, it coincided with RPGs and. There are different elements to it, but it really had traditional storytelling, which I miss in a lot of games. There are games that have stories, storytelling in them now, but most games seem to all be, you know, first person and, I don't know. It's just, it doesn't seem as interactive, because of the third person, environment. So, anyway. I want to move on now to talking about RPGs, role-playing games. RPGs started with pen and paper back in the day in the 70s with Dungeons & Dragons. And for a long time, a lot of people wanted to move that into the computer realm. Richard Garriott is probably one of the most famous, or probably, for me, he's one of the top people that really pushed or brought in the computer RPG genre. If you read a book, there's a book called Dungeons and Dreamers that came out a while back that talks about how Richard Garriott was young. When he was a young man, he spent a lot of time playing Dungeons and Dragons with his friends, and he got a computer. His father worked for NASA, I believe, and was an astronaut, and he wanted to create computer-based games based off of his Dungeons and Dragons adventures. So he created Ultima, that series is probably one of the was one of the longest running series during the 80s and 90s for role playing games. It got me into computer RPGs. The first game I bought, or the second game I bought, was Ultima 7, and a lot of people have said that this is probably the best Ultima game out of the series. Now there was a lot of Ultima games. Now people say like Ultima 2, Ultima 3, really made a lot of changes in the, really caused a lot of new things to happen in the RPG world during that time. But for me, I guess the whole history of RPGs. There's many companies during the 80s and 90s that developed RPGs. Origin Systems, or Origin was one, which was Ultima. Let me look online here. There were, you remember the Wizardry series? That was a big series. For me, Might and Magic by New World Computing was huge. I spent hours playing Might and Magic, all the different versions, all the way up into Might and Magic 6, I believe. There were other companies. Let's take a look here. There was a lot of companies. I just read an article. There was a recent Computer Games Magazine. It's in smaller publication that talked about some of the classic games. So if you go to Wikipedia and look up computer role playing game, there's a chronology of the games. Just kind of go through a little bit. 1981 was when the Ultima series debuted on the Apple II. Wizardry also came out. 1983 was when Ultima 3 came out. Also, you remember the Bard's Tale series was a great series. That came out in 1985. Might and Magic series debuted in 1987. Now, I totally remember drooling over ads for like Might and Magic 3 and Might and Magic 4 and 5 in the different like Computer Gaming World magazines. I mean, they look really cool. And I remember spending hours and hours playing Might and Magic 3. Also, if you remember the Gold Box series by SSI, they were the first to create the Dungeons & Dragons games for the computer. Pool of Radiance was the first one in 1988. And they came out. There was dozens of those, and they were the forerunners for, or they used that same concept of the Gold Box series for one of the first graphical MMORPGs, Neverwinter Nights, on AOL. They used that same type of format as the Gold Box series. Also, if you remember the Eye of the Beholder series, which was really good, that was also, I believe, was that SSI? Yeah, that was also SSI. I remember playing those a lot. Ultima 6 came out in 1990. And now, this is where a lot of the crossover... I want to talk a little bit about crossover with online games. During this time, not only did they have the tech... We talked about the text-based interactive fiction, text-based adventure games. The MUDs, or multi-user dungeons, began to develop in the 70s, where they would be they're online role-playing games, a lot like Dungeons & Dragons, but you played... it's all text-based, and you connect to a server, and you play with other people.
Now, those, it's amazing that those games started as early as the 70s. There's a, I have a book called Designing Virtual Worlds, by Richard Bartle, I think it is, Richard Bartle or Bartlett. And he was one of the first creators of a MUD, of the MUD, genre. And, it really developed over time. MUDs have been around for a long time, and they became, most people that started off, people that created Ultima Online and EverQuest and a lot of those online games and even into World of Warcraft probably played MUDs in the 80s at college. I know that I started off in, I used to play a MUD called Batmud when I was in college in the 90s. So kind of, it was kind of like a, I guess as people were developing computer role-playing games, they're always thinking in the back of their mind, eventually this could go online, or eventually we could merge the two. But they were always coinciding. The MUDs were being developed and people played them very heavily, but then when the graphical games came out, a lot of people switched over, to the graphical. It was like a natural evolution of online role-playing games. So the height of this, mid to late 80s and early 90s, was the height of the single-player role-playing game. Now, numerous games came out. Like I said, 1990, Ultima 6. 91 is when Neverwinter Nights was online with AOL. More of the Eye of the Beholder, more of the Gold Box series games. 1992, which was big, for Ultima Underworld. This was huge for me. I love this game. Ultima Underworld, the Stygian, or I think that's how you say it, the Stygian Abyss, which was a 3D, first-person role-playing game. And I love that game. And then also, Ultima Underworld 2 came out later after that. Let's see. Forgotten Realms Unlimited Adventures. Do you remember that? You can kind of create your own role-playing game within the game. It was really, really cool. Lands of Lore, Eye of the Beholder 3, Betrayal at Krondor. Remember that one? That was good, 1993. Elder Scrolls, Daggerfall, all that stuff began to come out. Fallout, which is a sci-fi based RPG, 97. And then that's kind of where we stop, because I don't want to go any further than that. But Ultima Online basically came out. And then that was at that point where the RPG genre was really hurting. And Diablo sort of helped it, but it was more of an action-based, you know, RPG. But then Baldur's Gate came out in 1998. Now, I didn't play it a whole lot, but I knew a lot of people that were playing it, and it kind of revitalized the RPG genre. And then, at that time, EverQuest hit the scene, and a lot of people started to move towards the online realm. And the RPG for me, pretty much, the single-player RPG pretty much died out. And people just really got more into the online part of it. So that's kind of a short history. So let's go back. I want to talk about Ultima 7. So Ultima 7 was incredible. I'm looking at the box now. I have the original box with the original discs. It came with 7 discs. Or excuse me, is that right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 discs. And this was a massive game. Like I said, I got this around 1992, and I could not, my hard drive was only 40 megabytes, so I could not have both Monkey Island 2 and Ultima 7 on the same hard drive. I couldn't have them both on with Windows at the same time. So I'd have to uninstall one game to play the other game. So, Ultima 7, I spent many hours playing that. It was a huge world. I mean, it started off right away. You're in the story. As soon as you start, you have the Guardian, which was the bad guy or the villain in the game. He's talking at you. It was like a static screen. As soon as the game loads up, like it's this. It says Ultima 7, has a little bit of intro, but it has this static screen where this 3D face, this red face, like comes out at you, and he's talking to you. And I had, I remember I didn't have a sound card in the beginning. when I got my first system. So all it was the text. So I just had to read the text. But once I got a sound card and I heard the voice, I was like, oh my gosh. I mean, it was this big booming voice, you know. It's like Avatar. And it was very, very cool. So, and as soon as that intro goes and then you go into the game, you're right in the story, and you're with your friend. You're pulled from a different dimension or something, and you're in this town, this medieval type town, and you know the text is going, and you're listening to a story. And as soon as you're done, the mayor comes up to you and talks to you. There's been a murder, and I mean the story was awesome. So right away at the beginning, it's like you can't stop playing because you've got to find out, you know, who killed this guy. And the storyline just like compels you to go further. So even in the first part of the game, you can't get out of the city without doing all the different detective work. You have to talk to all the different, some of the different townspeople, and find out information, go different places, find certain things. And so it mixed. It was an RPG because you have stats and you build up your abilities, but it was more towards an adventure side because there's things that you had to do and you had to talk to people. So I think a good mix of a role-playing game with an adventure game is the way to go. I mean, you're not just focusing. See, for me today, like World of Warcraft is great. I've played that a lot and I haven't played in a couple months, but for me there is story there, but you're just doing quests. You're just focusing on your stats and your armor and the game mechanics. Now, in the traditional sense of a role-playing game, that's true. That's what you should do. Back from Dungeons and Dragons, it's not really, and the story is great, but you're really focusing on stats. It comes out of wargaming. Dungeons and Dragons was birthed out of simulated war games. So you focus on stats. But for me, computer role-playing games have to have a good mix of story or storyline to be able to keep you interested and compelled to follow the story and to finish the game. So Ultima 7 was like this. There were things like when they came out with updates, there was a add-on called the Forge of Virtue, which dealt with the world having an earthquake or shaking. So once you installed the update to the game, when you started at the beginning of the game or the next time you ran the game, the screen started shaking, and that added an extra element. They say, oh, this is another part of the story that's going on, and the characters say, oh, what was that? And there must be something going on with this part of the world, and you're like, oh, I got to go there. I got to find out what's going on. So those kind of add-ons, those kind of things I think were really cool. Now, what's neat about Ultima 7, I feel, is Ultima 7 was really the seeds or the beginning for ideas and development of Ultima Online. And really, Ultima Online, which came out in 97, was the beginning of all of the online role-playing games, which are massive now. If it wasn't for that, well, there's a lot of things that if it really wasn't for MUDs, you wouldn't have World of Warcraft today, which has millions of users. So Ultima 7 really seemed to, all the concepts that you see in that really seemed to come over to Ultima Online, which was like, came out like 6 years later. So I spent a lot of time playing Ultima 7. It was really, really fun. I had a clue book. I'm looking here at some of the documentation is starting to get a little yellow. But you think, man, this I got this game like 15 years ago. So that was Ultima 7. So Origin, you know, came out with a bunch of games. Origin was a great company, great role-playing games, and they had a lot of different types of games. Ultima Underworld, which, like I said before, was a real breakthrough in some of the technology. I love this game a lot. I also spent hours and hours playing that. And also, I think I still have the discs, but I don't think they work either. So, but once again, I'm going to talk about that at the very end. So Ultima 7 also came out with like a part 2, the Serpent Isle, all that. I mean, it was just a massive, massive game. And Ultima Underworld was too. Very, very large game, very involved. Also Ultima Underworld too. So RPGs, I mean, the other ones I played, I dabbled with some of the other ones. They were, Ultima 8 was a bomb, though. It really, it did not do well. It was just, they used a lot of action-type features that just did not go over very well. But I played some of the Gold Box series, the Dungeons & Dragons SSI games. They were pretty fun. The graphics sucked, though. They were pretty bad. That's about it. I played Diablo, but once after that period came, this really for me and Might and Magic. I played Might and Magic 6 a whole lot, but that the single player RPG pretty much died off, and everyone started moving towards online games. So I will talk about in the next show specifically online gaming and kind of my history and of what I experienced with MMORPGs. Last thing I want to talk about on today's show is, if you don't know about this, and you probably do if you're into retro stuff, this is the greatest program to ever exist for people like us. It's called DOSBox. And if you don't know about this, you need to check it out. DOSBox is a x86 emulator. It pretty much emulates a 386, 486 type of system. You can take this program. It's currently in version 0.65. If you go to DOSBox, just do Google. Go to Google and type in DOSBox. I think it's the website is dosbox.sourceforge.net. It is an open source project. That's DOSBOX. Just do a search on Google for it. It came out a while back. I've used it over the past year or two. Basically, you can take any game. If you have the original files, which a lot of games you can find online somewhere, if you have the original files for a game, you can load it up and you can play those games exactly like they were back in the day with DOSBox. Now, the cool thing is that, and you can play it on your regular computer because you don't have to worry about... Remember some of the you remember using a program called Moslo, which would like reduce the processor speed by percentages so that it would play properly. Because if you run Ultima 7 or any of these games on your current computer, which is super fast, the game will play really, really fast, and everything's real fast and speed, and just it's horrible. You can't do anything because it's all sped up because of the processor. So with DOSBox, it emulates that 386 or 486 processor. So it is just like your old machine that you have out in the garage that you really don't want to get out because it's hot in the garage and you just don't want to fool with it. Because you may not have all the hardware drivers, or you might not have the original software for the computer, or, you know, whatever. You can't get the sound card to work or something like that. Well, and that's the other thing. DOSBox emulates the sound cards. So it sounds just the same as like if you use your old Sound Blaster Pro. So it's a great program. I've played many games with it, and I definitely this summer want to get back into it. They support a lot of games. If you go and look at their game section, you can see. I mean, it's literally like hundreds of games that they support. It's a great program. You got to check it out. It's really good, I think, for playing a lot of the Sierra games. For LucasArts games, there is, I think I've talked about this before, there's something called ScumVM, which is an emulator or virtual machine that you can load up the games, load up like Monkey Island 2, and you can play it within this virtual machine. It's called ScumVM, S-C-U-M-M-V-M. Do a search on that on the internet. And it is really just specifically geared towards emulating the Scum environment that was created by LucasArts. So it plays LucasArts games perfectly. But I still think you can use DOSBox to play play any of the LucasArts games too. But for a lot of those games that are not LucasArts, you can definitely play through DOSBox. So I would check that out. It'll take you back. There's a lot of games that you can find on the internet, or if you still have the original discs, that you can pop in there and set it up and go at it. So check out DOSBox and have fun with that. All right, well, that is it for today's show. This is a long one. We're right at about 1 hour, longest show ever. So, and like I said, this is a two-parter. And next week's program, we will talk about MMORPGs, online gaming, all the way from MUDs in the 80s, all the way up until probably like Ultima Online and EverQuest, maybe in the mid-90s. Going to talk a little bit about, remember, Meridian 59, the early Neverwinter Nights, Shadows of Eusebius, like I said, the MUDs of the time. We'll cover all the online gaming and the controversies and all the different experiences of online gaming next week. All right, well, have a great week, and thank you so much for listening. I appreciate all you faithful listeners out there. Keep sending me email. If you go to the website now, you'll see a direct link. My email address is podcast@boringbeigebox.com. Also, if you subscribe to iTunes, give me some reviews on iTunes. There's a section when you look at my podcast, you can review my podcast, and I think you can rate it. So definitely do that. And also jump on the forums. You can talk on the forums at forums.boringbeigebox.com. Thanks so much, guys. Talk to you soon, and have a great week.